We had come in our study of the book of James to the third chapter, in which James is telling the Christians of his day that the person who really has faith should live a Christian life, and that a real part of that is learning to control our tongues. And he says in verse 9 of this chapter, "Therewith, with the tongue, we bless God the Father, and therewith curse we men, made after the image or similitude of God." It's possible to use God's name in worship and then to use God's name in cursing. And he's saying, these things ought not so to be. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing. And he says, that's not right. And the illustration is in verse 11. "Doth a fountain, a spring, send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter?" You don't get salt water and sweet water at the same spring at the same time. All right, we ought not to get blessing and cursing from the same tongue of the same person. Another illustration, the same thing. "Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olive berries?" Of course not. It bears figs. "Either vine figs?" Well, we had grapes at our house this summer, but there weren't any figs on that grapevine. Well, of course not. That's the point. "So can no fountain yield salt water and fresh?" And no Christian tongue ought to yield cursing and other vile languages. Now, the next verse, the verse that follows, verse 13, "Who's a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation, a good life, his works, with meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth." Now, at this point, James is back to his discussion of earthly and heavenly wisdom. This wisdom descendeth not from above, man's wisdom. It's earthly, sensual, devilish. There is a human wisdom based on man's philosophy, and it's not from above. Where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. That's what comes when people follow man's wisdom instead of God's truth. Now, by way of contrast, verse 17, "The wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy." Real wisdom, real understanding results in a life that's pure, peaceable, easy to be talked to, full of mercy and good fruits, and that's impartial and sincere. "And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace." Now, as an illustration of that, he's going to talk about wars. From whence come wars and fightings among you? Where all these wars come from in history that cost so much, that produced death and wounds and wasted materials? Why does man fight big wars and small? Why the Hatfields and McCoys start a feud? Why does Cain kill Abel? Well, the answer is in Genesis 3 or Romans 3, and indirectly it's right here. It's because of man's sinful nature. I think it ought to be connected with the end of chapter 3. James didn't put these chapter divisions in. Now, they were put later. And I think he's talking about man's wisdom, man's decisions that lead to wars. Man goes to war because he is a sinner. Now, I know there is a wars that God instructed his people to fight, that they didn't start at all. But I'm talking about aggressive warfare, based on man's human nature. I've gotten in the habit of saying it this way, and I mean every phrase of this. If you don't believe in man's sinful nature, in Genesis 3, Romans 3, then just go through one war. That'll teach you. Teach school for 50 years, and I love the students I've taught, and it's a joy to still be in communion with so many of them. If you don't want to do that, and if you want to find out about human nature, raise a family. And I love my family. But if you don't want to do that, look in your own heart. Just really look in the mirror. That'll teach you about it. Or you can study the Bible. That'd be the simplest, most direct way to learn it. Here's man's nature. And in man's nature, he develops man's wisdom. And the result is that we have wars. Now, this is going to be spelled out further in chapter 4. From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence even of your lusts, your desires? This word translated lust here is usually translated pleasure. In Titus and 2 Peter, motives are basic in everything. Folks steal because they're covetous, kill because they hate and covet. Folks go as missionaries because of their motives, their love of God and man. And James says in verse 2, you lust, you want these pleasures, and you don't have what you want, and so you kill, desire to have and cannot obtain, and so you fight and war, and yet you have not because you ask not. Here's the idea that some things we do not have because we didn't pray for them. We're going to have over a few pages from here that Elijah was a man subject to like passions as we are. He got scared. He got discouraged. He prayed earnestly that it might not rain. Rain not on the earth by the space of 3 years and 6 months. Some things we do not have because we do not pray. And then verse 3, you ask and receive not. Sometimes folks pray and don't get an answer. Because you ask amiss, that you may consume it upon your pleasures or lusts. There is such a thing as praying selfishly. There is such a thing as praying selfishly for things that are just not in God's will and that are not good for us. And again, my story is that when the four-year-old asks for an automobile, or rifle, you'd better not give him what he asks for. Sometimes we Christians can ask amiss. Now, this doesn't mean that if we just sincere, God will give us everything we ask for. Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 12 about his thorn in the flesh, his physical affliction, probably eye trouble there. There are four passages that point to that, but he doesn't say what it was. It was a physical affliction. And Paul says, I prayed about this three different times. And God said, no, my grace is sufficient for you. Paul needed this affliction. Now, that's his teaching. And there are factors like that in prayer. But the basic thing here is that ye have not because ye ask not. Now, in verse 4, here's a section where James goes back to the Old Testament, and he says, ye adulterers and adulteresses. Now, that's the Old Testament use of this. Oh, it probably included immorality. But when the book of Hosea uses a word like this, it's talking about unfaithfulness to God. Hosea's wife, Gomer, ran off and left him. Got mixed up in one of these immoral cults of that day. And Hosea went and bought her back, redeemed her. And the prophet's message is that Israel was like Gomer. Surely, this is Jeremiah now, surely as a wife treacherously departeth from her husband, so have ye dealt treacherously with me, O house of Israel. And James is here warning these people that they should not be unfaithful to God, whom they have claimed as their Lord and Master when they became Christians. And James says, whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world, friend of the godless world now, is an enemy of God. And God gives grace, but he resists the proud. And so we have the idea in verse 7, resist the devil and he will flee from you. You resist the devil by prayer. You resist the devil by resolution. You resist the devil by Bible study. You resist the devil by being busy about God's work. You resist the devil, Jesus did, by quoting Scripture. And this says, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw nigh to God. Draw near to God, and he'll respond. He'll draw nigh unto you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded. Some folks just need to be forgiven. They need to be washed. Their hearts need to be purified. And, of course, that salvation is what God gives. Now, in the verse that follows, it talks about how the Spirit earnestly desires people. God's Spirit. The way Hosea was seeking Gomer. God wants the Spirit to do his work. And verse 6 of chapter 4 says God gives more grace. He resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble, to the man who can pray, God be merciful to me, a sinner. And then verse 7 says that Christians are submit to God. Submit yourselves therefore to God as servants. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Submit to God and then draw near unto God. And verse 9, be afflicted and mourn and weep. There are times when repentance ought to lead us to sorrow. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to heaviness. And humble yourselves in the sight of God. And when we come humbly in confession, when we draw near to God, then he will lift us up. Now, verse 11, he's back to the practical that's so typical of the book of James. Do not speak evil of another, brethren. He that speaks evil of his brother and judges his brother is making a judge out of himself. And he's saying to these folks, don't go around passing critical judgments on fellow Christians. We may not know their motives. We may not know their problems. Now, this doesn't mean that we're to put blinders on our eyes and not face up to reality, but we're not to be censorious, critically judgmental. You have the verse 12 that tells us that there's one lawgiver who's able to save and to destroy, and we're not that lawgiver. Who art thou that judgest another man's servant, is the way Paul would phrase it. Then there's a section here about plans for the future. How do you make plans? Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. You folks who are making plans for life and for business, well, there's some things you need to notice. Ye know not what shall be on the morrow. Life is as a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. Life is uncertain, like a morning cloud. Now, this doesn't mean we shouldn't make any plans. Paul made plans about going to Spain in Romans 15. Incidentally, Paul's friend Clement tells us that he got there. And the book of Acts doesn't tell us a thing about it, but it talks about, we do have the phrase, the limits of the West for Paul's preaching. Very probably, Paul worked out his plan that God had put in his heart to go to Spain. Now, the rich fool made plans about the new barns and all without God, and that's what's being talked about here. It's possible to make our plans for the future and not to take God into account. There's the uncertainty of life. Paul's going to say, I will return again unto you if God will. That's, I think, Acts 18:21. And here's just the idea that as we make our plans for life, we need to take God into account and realize that we're God's creatures. Then in verse 17, the end of this chapter, there's this very important verse, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Well, if you want to make school teacher unhappy, you don't have to put fresh paint on the blackboard and throw the chalk away and break out the windows. You all make school teacher unhappy, you just don't do anything. It's that way. Him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. There is such a thing as sinning by not saying anything when you ought to speak. There is such a thing as sinning by not giving when you ought to give. There is such a thing as sinning by not doing what you know you ought to do. There are sins of omission. That servant which knew his Lord's will and prepared not himself shall be beaten with many stripes. Luke 12. The priest and the Levite saw the wounded man by the road. Yeah, but their sin was a sin of omission. They passed by on the other side. The man with one talent buried his talent. He buried his talent. That was a sin of omission. Modern man doesn't understand the seriousness of sin because he doesn't really know about God's creation and God's holiness, God's salvation, and he doesn't want a God in his knowledge. The doctor had better tell some people that they're sick. The Bible tells us about man's sickness and the remedy. There is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. There is a remedy for man's sin. Now, in the fifth chapter of the book of James, he's back to talk to the rich people who were much more domineering in that day than corresponding rich people today, perhaps. But you rich men, weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. You might lose everything. And he talks about moths and rust and things like that. I expect if he were writing today, he'd put in the word inflation. Oh, he says, ye have heaped treasures together for the last days. There was such a thing as worshiping riches, just like there still is. And now, this goes on to say that some folks in that day and time got their riches unfairly. They didn't pay the laborers. They just deliberately retained the pay of those who had worked in their fields. And James says, you've lived in pleasure, and you've condemned and killed the just, and this is going to lead to judgment. Now, in verse 7, there's the call for patience. And be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Be patient. The husbandman, the farmer, waits for the precious fruit of the earth. It's been about an hour since I dug the sweet potatoes. I mean today. I planted those things back in May, and I worked on them in May. Worked on them a little bit in June. I waited all of July and August and September, and I wasn't impatient. It wasn't time to dig them. But this morning I thought it was all right, and it was a good crop. I'm saying the farmer learns to wait months and months and months. And that's the illustration that's right here. Brethren, behold, the husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth. We ought to learn patience in the church. We ought to learn patience. And verse 8 says, and establish your hearts. We ought to be patient because Jesus is coming back again. Grudge not one against another, brethren, lest ye be condemned. Warning against grumbling and complaining. And then take the prophets as an example of suffering affliction and of their patience. There's the patience of Job he mentions in verse 11. These prophets learned patience because they knew about God's tomorrow. Then there's the warning about profane swearing, taking God's name in oaths when it's not proper. Now, the Bible talks about places where it's perfectly proper to swear. In Deuteronomy 6, thou shalt fear the Lord thy God, serve him, and swear by his name. I don't think I did anything wrong in taking an oath when I joined the army. I don't think so. I helped a Chinaman once become an American citizen. He took an oath. Well, I think that was proper. And I'd base it on a whole list of verses I have here. Jeremiah says, thou shalt swear the Lord liveth in truth, in judgment, and in righteousness. There are times in the Bible when it was perfectly proper to take an oath, but James is talking about this casual, light, irreverent swearing, and he says, don't do that. Now, there are the what-to-do verses. Verse 13, is anybody afflicted? Let him pray. You got troubles? Pray about it. Is anybody just real happy? Let him sing psalms. Let him worship. Is any sick? Let him call for the elders of the church and let them pray over him and anoint him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of faith shall save the sick. God shall raise him up. God raises up people who are sick, and we are to pray for sick people. Now, verse 16 has something that's very important. Confess your faults one to another, and pray one for another, that ye may be healed. Sometimes we need to talk about our problems to a Christian we can trust. Now, don't tell everything you've ever done to everybody you meet. There is such a thing as telling too many people the wrong story. I've been school teacher for, I've told you, right at 50 years, and half that time I was college dean of students. And that's all right to tell this now. I have such a clear picture in my mind of students coming to see me and sitting down for 40 minutes maybe and just pouring out their hearts over some problem. And when they get through, it's a standard procedure. They get up and they say, oh, thank you so much for helping me. I feel so much better. And of course, I realize I hadn't hardly said a word. They hadn't given me a chance. Well, now, what this means is that just confessing this to somebody they trusted in a Christian context brought relief. James just says, confess your faults one to another, and then pray one for another, that you may be healed, because prayer is effective. And then it talks about Elijah's prayer, how he prayed, and how God answered his prayer in sending the drought, and sending the fire from heaven to burn up the sacrifice. He prayed again, the heaven gave rain. Now, the next section talks about our influence on the straying brother. If this man strays from the truth, if any of you do err from the truth, and one convert him, turn him back, reclaim him, reclaim the backslider, then that's the thing to do. Let him know that he which converteth the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death, and shall cover, hide a multitude of sin. Paul would simply say, If a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such an one in the spirit of meekness. Don't get him down and kick the daylights out of him. When somebody has stumbled, help him get up again. Now, the book of James is the kind of book that I wish we had a little longer to give a summary. But you know, this is written by James, the son of Mary and Joseph, the half-brother of Jesus. He was an unbeliever until after the resurrection when Jesus appeared to him personally. He became a leader of the church in Jerusalem. He had a big part in the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15. He has a great emphasis on practical Christian living. The idea that true religion must include service to the needy. True religion must include self-control, bridling the tongue, keeping oneself unspotted from the world. James emphasizes the idea that faith is more than knowledge. Oh, it includes knowledge. That faith without works is dead. Thou believest that God is one, thou doest well. The devils also believe and tremble. And he talks about how Abraham and Rahab were justified before men. Now, they were justified before God by their faith. And he quotes Genesis 15:6 again about God's salvation. Abraham believed God. That's how he was saved. How James wants people to be saved. James holds Paul's doctrine of salvation, but he insists that real faith must result in action, in works, in Christian lifestyle. It's been a privilege to go through this book of James with you in this study.